Hey everybody, this is Wayne.
Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Wayne Klingman up here in Block Talk Line with another very interesting show of the Chicago Outfit Blended Streets. Yes, today we have Phyllis Cook coming back with us today to talk about part two. In part two, to talk about what happened with her family, meaning her father and her brother, with their dealings with what we're referring to as the Dixie Mafia. So with no further ado, allow us to introduce you to Phyllis Cook again, and she'll give us a little brief update, and she'll go on, catch us up, and go on further. All right, good morning, ma'am.
Good morning, or afternoon, whatever. How are you today, yes. Wayne?
We're fine, and I appreciate the time that we had to chat off the air. It's weird out there. Anyway, with no further ado, let's get into the meat of the show. Let us have a brief recap of what we talked about last time, and then take us up from there. But before we do that, I must say this is a show of opinion and the like. Anybody, the whole nine yards, people are innocent until proven guilty in court of law. This show may not be the opinion of Blog Talk Radio. All right, we have to see these things in today's society. Anyway, with that out of the way, please, ma'am, go on.
Well, as last week I had talked about my old brother, Ronald Wayne Anderson, who was 17 at the time that he was murdered, and my father, Lieutenant Dan Anderson, who was 80 at the time he was murdered. And come to find out, they were both murdered by members of the Dixie Mafia. Now, as I stated last week, they were just a bunch of loosely knit thug guys that got together that formed a group of killing and murdering and robbing anything for a dollar. And a highway patrolman named Rex Armistead, he dubbed them and named them the Dixie Mafia. So that's pretty much how they got their name. But now they were in with some others that I guess you could say they're Dixie Mafia. I'm not really up on all of it, but I know that Towhead White and a lot of them, they were in with the State Line Mob back in 67. And back in 67 is when my little brother, Ronald Wayne Anderson, was murdered. He was shot. We were told he was shot, and it was suicide. And like I had said, for 35 years, I was told that he was had committed suicide. I knew that he did not, had knew some of the people involved. Now, this is going to be sort of hard to try to put it to where, to keep it from my brother to my daddy, but to keep it in perspective, I will say, you know, that I did not know about the Dixie Mafia involved with my family's murders until 2013. I had called the Gulfport, the Harrison County Sheriff's Department, for like 30, 40-something years. Well, from 1967 until 2002, I called Gulfport, the Harrison County Sheriff's Department. I was told it was a suicide, but they would work on it, they would investigate it, different things like that. Like I said, every time I'd call the Gulfport Police Department or Sheriff's Department, my dad would stop me, never knowing why. 2002, sitting in the Waffle House. Of course, my dad sees the guy that had murdered my old brother sitting behind me, unknowing to me who he was at the time. My dad mumbles a couple of curse words and dares me to turn around. The guy gets up, leaves, and as he's leaving, of course, I analyze him up and down. My dad tells me, he said, "Do you know who that was?" And I said, "No." He said, "That's Jeffrey Dennis Bass. That's the old boy that killed Ronnie." Well, like I said last week, that was the first time in 35 years that my father ever admitted that my brother was murdered. 4 months later, on April the 18th, which would be probably just another couple of days now from here, my father was gunned down, allegedly to have been gunned down in his driveway, shot in the head. They said that the police want me to believe that my father walked out there on a Friday afternoon, busy throughway street, 4:30 in the afternoon, people getting off from work. The neighbors so close to you can carry on a normal conversation sitting on the porch with them. And that he took his service revolver in a holster and shot himself in the head. The lady that was alleged to have found him had just been there for about 4 weeks, moved in. She said she answered an ad in the paper as a housekeeper. I've never found that ad or that article with any newspaper that I have called. I've never seen an article and did not know that my dad had ever ran an article, and if so, he would have told me. I personally feel she was put there as a plant to watch my dad until my dad could be murdered. The reason I feel my dad was murdered along with my brother, as my dad's car was gone, never to have been found at this, but it exchanged hands with two different people, allegedly. Come to find out just a couple months ago that the attorney friend that I questioned about my dad's car was also in high profile with the Dixie Mafia. He sold my dad's car to this lady. It's been confirmed by her daughter, and when I asked her daughter why or who sold her the car, she explained that it was sold by an attorney, Roy Strickland. It was sold in May, and the reason I say she said she went back through her journals and was looking through the journal, and it said all hell broke loose at mom's. We've lost the keys to the Caddy. She said that was in May. I asked her how would her mom be associated with Roy Strickland. She stated that her brother had been in prison quite a bit and had gotten out, so apparently it was dealings with the attorney. Well, as I searched her family tree and some of the other family trees, I found out that they're all connected and all kin, and she did know the lady that was working as the housekeeper, because when I questioned her if she knew this Cherry Learn, she said she knew a big, heavyset lady named Cherry Learn, but her daughter, she thought her daughter knew her. She said that she didn't personally know her, but then she came back in next conversation stating that she had cleaned apartments with this Cherry Learn and her husband, and she described him, so I knew that she knew who she was talking about. After I mentioned about my dad and everything, she did not want to talk, so I knew that the car was all involved in it. I've also found out some information on my brother as to how I know for a fact that he was murdered. But like I'm going to say, I'm going to go to 2013, backtrack to then, and tell that on February the 5th, I was sitting at my desk looking out the window and just thinking about my daddy and Ronnie. And there's so much I want to try to get in this show, so I won't go into complete all details, but I had called the Gulfport Police Department, well, I called the Harrison County Sheriff's Department, as I had done all the 40-something years. I was told that I need to speak to someone in the police department, that it was the jurisdiction of the police department. So they gave me to an Adam Cooper, who was an investigator. I explained about my brother's death. I did not mention my dad so he would not think that I would not accept both of them, you know, committing suicide. As I explained my brother's death and what I felt happened and the people involved, he asked me to hold on. He came back and he said, hold on, let me look in this file. As he was looking in the file, he said, Ms. Cook, he said, I am 99.9% sure that your brother was murdered by a member of the Dixie Mafia. And I said, why are you telling me this? He said, because everyone you're naming are members of the Dixie Mafia. At that point, I told him, I said, I know who it was. I said, it was Jeffrey Dennis Bass. Well, he asked me if I could identify the guy, and I told him I sure could. Well, he then said, he said, they are the ones that killed the prominent Judge Sherry and his wife on the Gulf Coast in 87. Well, unknowing to me the magnitude of what I'm about to say, I explained to him. I said, oh, my gosh. I said, my dad worked for Judge Sherry. I said, my dad was Judge Sherry's bailiff. He was working with him at the time. He told me, nope. And I said, my dad and Pete Hallett are the ones that found the bodies. Once again, he says, no, they did not find the bodies. I explained that, yes, they did. I explained how my dad had gotten to the house that morning, went in to he'd gotten a call from the courthouse stating that they said court was wanting to be heard. And I think I told this last time, Wayne, but
yeah,
I'll go ahead and do it just a little rough down. But anyway,
please.
My dad and Pete Hallett did find the bodies, and my dad and Pete Hallett were the first ones on the scene at the Sherry's murders on the morning of September the 15th, because they was murdered September the 14th. When my dad called over to ask Pete Hallett if Judge Sherry was there, and he said no, I personally feel that Pete Hallett jumped at the chance to go with my dad over there to make sure that they were dead and everything was okay, because he told my dad to go home and let him handle it and not tell anyone anything, that he would take care of it, that he didn't want the media or the kids to get wind of it. Well, as my dad got home, I was the first one to make contact when he walked in the door. And, of course, he told me everything. Positions of the bodies, the cookies and milk and coffee and everything on the counters, Well, in 2015, I called and spoke with a Steve Dalhousie, who was the corner for the Sherrys. He did not want to talk to me. He told me that Pete Hallett and the Dixie Mafia had made his life a living hell, and he did not want to discuss it. I kept telling him exactly what happened after he, I had to listen to me because I would not hush. And he told me, he said, lady, he said, I don't know you. He said, but there's no way in hell you would know that information unless you or your dad, one, was in that house before I got there. He said, because you're telling me things that I never put in my notes. So that confirmed, even though I knew that my dad would not have lied and my dad told the truth, it put a second confirmation to the fact of everything that happened for me, and I was satisfied with that. So that's how, you know, my dad was murdered because of information he held on the Sherry's murders and information that he also held on my little brother's murders. Now, I want to go to that John Ransom, the hitman. I saw John Ransom in a Waffle House, and I had put in my notes that I saw John Ransom in 1997. And after I was contradicted as to the date that I had seen him, or the year, should I say, I went back and I kept thinking, what was I doing? Why was I at this Waffle House? And I went back through my papers and things, and I remembered I had gone to pick up some deeds on some land that we had sold. When I pulled the deeds and the land and stuff out, it was 1989, the end of 1989, whenever I saw John Ransom in the Waffle House. I heard him and a woman sitting behind me. She made the remark, said, they shot old Sherry and they got Margaret too. I immediately turned around and I asked her if she was talking about Judge Sherry and his wife on the Gulf Coast. The man never spoke. The woman never spoke. She never turned around. He looked at me for a moment. He got up and he just sort of glared. He paid for the food and he went out the door. Well, I only had a pager at that time. So when I got home, I called my dad. When I told my dad what had happened, my dad just went irate. He kept saying, what does he look like? What did he say to you? Over and over, he kept just hysterically almost like repeating it. And I kept telling him, nothing, Daddy. He didn't say anything. In a few minutes, my dad said, he was just an old scroungy-looking guy, and he limped out the door. When I said that, my dad said, good God Almighty. He said, that's John Ransom. He said, that's the son of a, that he and Pete Hallett murdered Sherry. And my dad made me promise I would never tell anyone. I would let him handle it. So I never said anything else to anyone else. The court transcripts in 97, a court reporter that worked for Judge Sherry, Ruth Potomi, she brought my dad copies of all the court transcripts of the Sherry's trial. My dad, after a couple of weeks, sent them to me, told me to put them up and never tell anyone I had them. Well, I scanned over, but they didn't mean anything to me because my dad had protected me from knowing about the Sherry's murders. So it didn't, and I never associated my brother's murder with the Dixie Mafia. So I put those up. As I got them out, once I found out in 2013 about the Dixie Mafia, I'd remembered, and I saw on one of them, there was a note that said, when it was on Pete Hallett's deposition, like, and it said, see other page. Well, I remember calling my dad, and I said, Daddy, I said, I was reading over these things that you sent, and I said, it says, see next page. I said, what do you want me to see on the next page? My daddy said, well, I don't know, Dickus, but what does it say? And I told him it said that Pete Hallett knew about the Sherry's murders before the coroner, and all my dad, like I say, he went crazy again, told me, put them up, never get those SLBs out again. I mean, it was like he panicked again. So that was most of my extent. Now I'm going to say that when I finally kept writing, and I did not get the picture of Jeffrey Bass whenever Adam Cooper asked me if I could identify Jeffrey Bass, and I told him, sure. This was February the 5th of 2013. I did not receive the police lineup of the six-man lineup until May the 9th and of 2013. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, how could he send these on May the 9th? Because May the 9th was my little brother's birthday, the one that was murdered. But I positively identified Jeffrey Bass as the guy that I knew as Jeffrey Bass, as the guy that people on Facebook had, that knew, have come forward, informants, I guess you want to call them, or just good people that have been nice enough to come forward and share information. They positively identified him. Well, this Captain Peterson came back and told me, said, the guy you've posted on Facebook is not Jeffrey Bass. I said, yes, it is. He said, no. He said, I have found the real Jeffrey Bass. And I said, what, after 46 years you finally found the real Jeffrey Bass? He stated that he brought Jeffrey Bass in, a Jeffrey Bass, and that he was only 15 at the time. He was not 18 like I had stated. I said, how could a 15-year-old share an apartment and expenses with my brother? Because my brother was working at McDonald's part-time. I said, this Jeffrey Bass was 18, almost 19 years old. He told me that Jeffrey Bass was going to buy, that they had taken two guns to go down to a dump to shoot the guns, but they did not think that one of the guns had a firing pin in it, a 410. And I said, well, why would they be carrying around a gun that they didn't think had a firing pin in it? And I said, if the guy went home and took the gun home, why did he just take one and not take two? Well, how ironic that they could not remember, they can remember the guns, but they can't remember the guy that brought them over. They could remember that there was a nurse involved, and I said, they said that Jeffrey Bass ran upstairs and grabbed a nurse when my brother shot himself. I said, no, the nurse was my stepmother, Jeffrey Bass's aunt. I said, there was no nurse upstairs. And he said, and Jeffrey Bass was going to take Ronnie to go buy him some deck shoes. I said, Captain Peterson, I said, my brother could not wear deck shoes. My brother had polio when he was 3 years old. I said, we had to buy two different size shoes and insert the brace into the smaller of one shoe for him to wear it. I said, he couldn't wear a deck shoe. I did not realize the impact of that deck shoe. That just was like it kept echoing. I knew there was something when he was saying deck shoe, because a deck shoe you associate with a boat, but I never could understand what. But more or less, everything that I had said and all of my information that had been sent to them in requests for the FOIA information, Freedom of Information, and in all the podcasts that I had done, it was like he had fabricated, and I'm saying this plain, I mean, I mean what I'm saying, he had fabricated the FOIA request out of information that he had gotten from my documents and from my podcast and stuff, because he was reiterating everything that I was saying. But he was doing so in a way to where, you know, it looked like they had all the information. And I'm asking him, how could you obtain this much information in 1967 to 2017? No one gave me anything, never told me nothing. But when I start posting on Facebook that I'm getting help, all of a sudden you come forward with all of this information.
Can I interrupt you with a question?
Sure, please.
As you tell the story, it seems to me you're having problem after problem dealing with government officials whose job it is to assist you. Did you ever think of hiring a lawyer to help you to cut through some of this paperwork bullshit?
Well, I have called, and it's like they want so much money, more money than I can afford at the time. I have tried. I've even, you know, hoped that somebody would come forward and help me pro bono. Or if not pro bono, you know, help me and me pay them just so much that where I could get this done, because I truly feel that if I could ever get it in front of the courts or in front of a judge, there's been mentions of it being taken in the RICO, under the RICO Act or whatever, but it's just that I do not personally have the money. I've exhausted everything through the years trying to get something done, you know, so if I could get
it. I just have to ask, because obviously, you're trying your very, very best job as a member of the public, utilizing the laws which are written for the use of the public to see what can't be done. And yet, there's barriers that, I'm sorry, it seems that a member of the public can't overcome without an attorney. And I feel bad about that.
Yeah, because, I mean, they won't release any crime scene photos. When I ask, Captain Peterson. I said, just send me one crime scene photo. I said, if you'll show me one photo of my dad lying in the driveway with blood running out of his head or blood down in the carport in the driveway, I said, then I might can come back and say, okay, let's talk a different avenue. I said, but right now you won't even show me a crime scene photo or anything. He sort of just, just a eerie kind of laugh. He said, well, Miss Cook, he said, why don't you come to Gulfport and we'll show you the picture. You know, it was one of those I took as a personal, well, why don't you come on up here, honey, and we'll show you what we got. And I was told by different people, even people that are in law enforcement, stay out of Mississippi. But I did have a lady come forward. I cannot name those people. Well, I say I can, but I'd rather not name those people for protection of them at the moment. If and when it ever gets to court or I get an attorney, I would be glad to share the names of the people. A lady came forward, and she said, yes, that's Jeffrey Bass. She said, that is the Jeffrey Bass that we know. Yes, he was involved in the Dixie Mafia, told a lot of the things about him and positively identified him. I even know where he is at the moment. He's still alive. In October, just this past October, I was on a phone conversation with a lady that is an advocate that helps people. I did not realize what she was doing at the moment, but she said, hold on just a moment. She three-wayed me in to someone else. When that person answered, they had no knowledge that I was on the other line. She said, I want to ask you a question. She said, tell me what you know about Kursky Nix. And the lady said, well, I know a lot about him. Said, I've known him all my life. And she said, he's bad. Said, he's mean. She was scared of him. She said, okay. She said, what can you tell me about a little boy named, or a young man named Ronnie Anderson? This person came back and said that they knew Ronnie Anderson, that he was called the little cripple boy. And this lady, when you know how when you've got family, your mama, your daddy, your wife, or your kids, if they tell you something and nothing strikes a nerve or nothing relates, you think, well, okay, maybe. But when they tell you or they use a phrase or they use something that you honestly can relate to and know, then you pretty much know they're telling the truth. And this lady, well, this person said that the night that Ronnie was killed, because she asked, why was he killed? She voluntarily started telling. And she said that they had, that Kursky Nix, Irvin Moore, Jeffrey Bass, and a guy named Olness White, I think they call him Ole, but his name Olness White, they got Ronnie to go with them, said that Ronnie didn't want to go, but they made him go. And they went to McNary, Tennessee. And when Buford Pussard got the call to leave the house, that they were going to have Ronnie go up and knock on the door. And when Pauline Pusser came to the door, of course, she would see a little skinny crippled boy standing there, and she would open the door. When she was to open the door, they were going to kill her. They saw her pass in the car with Buford Pusser that night. So they followed the car, and that is when they shot Buford and they murdered Pauline Pusser. Well, Ronnie knew it. And it was not even quite 6 weeks whenever Ronnie was murdered, because I had called with an eerie feeling that something was going on and him to come live with me. They knew that if he left, he was going to possibly tell what had happened. So she said, At that point, I spoke up, and I couldn't hold it back. And I said, can you tell me, Brenda, how... And there I have. See, I'm not good, Wayne, at beating around the bush or candy coat.
Don't worry about it.
When I start talking, it just all comes out. I mean, I'm sorry. But anyway, she said that I lost my train of thought because I was trying to be so careful. But anyway, she said that that Ronnie was lured down to the boat dock. I said, how did they kill him? I said, what happened? She said, this Kathy had lured Ronnie down to the boat dock. That's the little Kathy, the little girl that called that night screaming, he killed him, he killed him. Said that when they got him at the boat dock, Irvin Moore and Kursky Nix and this here Olness White and some other ones that were in there, there were several more of them, said that they beat him unmercifully. And then this is when she said, this is what tears my heart out. She said,
take a breath. It's okay. Take the time that you need. We understand. We understand that you went through quite a bit here. You've been struggling with this situation over the years. We understand that this is very, very emotional to you. And take the time that you need to compose yourself. And we're waiting here patiently. I think it's a very, very brave act that you're doing.
Yeah. This is what just kills me, because I'm just finding so much of this out that I know. I mean, I know it's the truth. But anyway, she said that that they took Ronnie down to the docks, and like I said, once they beat him unmercifully, she said, and this is the exact words that was said, Jeffrey Bass took it one step forward. She said that he shot him in the head.
Wow.
So, you know, and I knew Jeffrey Bass was the one that killed my brother. I knew this, and I have told the police this. I've told everybody this. You know, and they know that Pete Hallett killed the Sherrys in the book of the Mississippi Mud. You know, that it tells about them seeing the guy leaving through there and stuff, running through the golf course. Kursky Nix tells that there was a guy in dress slacks and a white shirt. They knew it was Kursky Nix. They knew it was John Ransom that murdered the Sherrys with Pete Hallett. Investigator Keith Bell, or agent, I guess he's FBI agent, him and Cook, they were in the jail talking to John Ransom when John Ransom said, you know, he said, I told my family that I would never have to tell them a lie. He said, but now I have to tell them that, he said, I told them I would never kill a woman. He said, but now I've got to tell them that I've killed a woman. And he said they knew that he was talking about Margaret Sherry, and they knew that he was confessing there. But yet the U.S. Marshals came in. I mean, they've got all this evidence. Why would they not do anything? Kursky Nix is still alive. Jeffrey Bass is still alive. Irvin Moore is still alive. If I could just ever get an attorney or someone that would help me get this in court, there's enough proof.
Now, obviously, you sent me a bunch of papers, which I really, really appreciate it. Very, very informational. I learned a lot from them. And yes, it seems that with an attorney, you could do something. And I also, I don't know, because I'm not a lawyer, I don't play one on TV. You know, some of it seems to be that the federal government could be involved. And I take you've communicated with the FBI and other agencies about what happened, right?
Yes.
And I take it they've been of no help either, or they tell you, they give you the runaround?
Well, I called the FBI in Mississippi, and I was explaining everything to him. And the guy told me, he said, Matthew Campbell, he's an agent. I've dealt with him, several of the others. They said that, he asked me, said, well, ma'am, what do you want? He said, do you realize that if we open this case, that it's going to change history? I said, do you realize that history needs to be changed? It's based on a lie? And that was as far as I've ever gotten. Alan Thompson, Mississippi Bureau of Investigations, I called Alan Thompson. He told me a case this old that he didn't have anything on it. I said, Captain Peterson and Adam Cooper, they have all the file and stuff on it. Well, then after Adam Cooper read out of the file, I mean, gave me information out of the file, then all of a sudden he got reprimanded. He went from the cold case investigator to activity coordinator. When I complained about it, all of a sudden he went up to lieutenant, but he never would get back with me. And then this Captain Peterson, he told me when I asked for my brother's files, he said, I don't have anything on your brother's files. He said, we've filed everything under your dad's. I said, how can you file a cold case unsolved murder of my brother from 1967 under my dad's in 2003? If they're not connected, how can you file them under the same thing?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Please go ahead.
Obviously, with no offense meant, ma'am, at all, this situation is way beyond normal. Any member of the public to deal with a lawyer who knows the ins and outs and the like. I'm saddened that the FBI. How long ago did you last communicate with the FBI?
I've been dealing with them from 1967 pretty much up until just here this past year.
Okay, the last year.
I spoke to Alan Thompson, 2018. Alan Thompson, Matthew Campbell.
And Alan Thompson is the one that told you that it would change history if you looked into it?
Matthew Campbell.
And how long ago was that conversation?
Last year.
Okay. And you've documented that, correct?
Yes, I do. I have all the numbers, the dates that I've called, and everything.
Wow. Yeah. I don't know if it would do any good to write your U.S. Senator to the President of the United States. I mean, at this time, it seems it can't do any harm because...
I wrote the governor's office. The governor's office, I got a thing back from Geraldine, whatever her name was. She told me they only handle blue-collar things like insurance and stuff. I have all of their emails, the documents and dates and everything. They wouldn't open it up. They would not help me. I called the Mississippi Bureau of Investigations in Jacksonville. They keep putting me off. I've called everybody I can think of.
Yeah. Yeah, and obviously they know, and no disrespect men at all, they know that agencies, the government knows they can push off a member of the public and keep them off for some time.
And they stall you. They say, well, we'll investigate it. Let us look into it. Well, they go for months and months, and you finally, you don't want to harass or be ugly, and you so you wait and you give them months and months, and then you call back. Well, yes, ma'am, we've got an investigator looking at it. As soon as he gets off a vacation, he'll call you. There goes more months, and that's what they've done until now. It's more years and more years.
Yeah, and sadly, I have to say, we see this all the time. I've talked to people both locally and around the country who not going through anything remotely as serious as you're dealing with, but yet they know a situation, they try to identify what's going on, try to get help, and they get pushed off and pushed off and pushed off.
I don't have any other family. I don't have any other family to help or to do anything, so it's not like we have aunts and uncles and cousins or anybody that'll pitch in and do. I don't have any of that.
Right. You don't have an uncle or somebody who's a lawyer. You don't know some
no,
of the family.
No, my dad's mom's people are all... I have one aunt on my mother's side, and that's it.
It's getting a lawyer. It might be beyond your means at this particular time, but who knows what might happen in the future. I didn't mean to sidetrack the conversation. It's just so painful
for
me
that's,
here.
That's very important because I would love if there's somebody out there that, would help and would let me make payments or would help me pro bono. Any way that they could help me, I would love it. And, I mean, I'm open for any suggestions. Just like on my brother, no autopsy was ever done on my brother, nothing. And there was no newspaper articles, no media, no anything. Well, they say, it's not rare that an autopsy is not done back in 67.
Right.
So I said, okay. Then on my daddy's autopsy, it states one recent gunshot wound to the head entering the right temple, contact exiting the left temple through the brain, no bullet in the brain, blood spatter and powder particles on both hands. Well, both hands, that's like a defense maneuver because my dad didn't have to use both hands. He had a hammerless service revolver that had like a hairline trigger. My dad, a police officer, he would not have walked out in the middle of the day with his pants unzipped, fly open, bare feet in his socks or whatever, in the middle of the driveway to shoot himself. He wasn't a attention seeker. He would have done so in the house. It said contusions and abrasions on the left partial scalp and the front toe. Why did he have bruises and scrapes on his feet? I've had professional people that are looking into this tell me your dad was drugged. They drug your daddy. Wherever your daddy was shot at, they drug him. That's where the scrapes and the bruises on his abrasions on his toes and stuff have come from. The blood spatter to his pants.
Unfortunately, how do I put this? I'm going to use the word competent here for a moment. Competent legal help, i.e. an attorney, an investigative license to do investigations. People can say what they want, and sadly, they will. and that doesn't sign up very well. But again, so how do, if someone out there who's listening to the show somehow can help you, or send you to someone who can help, perhaps there's a group out there that can be of some assistance, how can they get a hold of you?
I have an email of Cheyenne, that is C-H-Y-A-N-N-E, Cheyenne1247@att.net. They can contact me through my Facebook page of Murdered in Mississippi. And, you know, I'm not even really, I'm not even afraid to give my home number. Everybody else has it.
Let's not give out the home number.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have a Facebook page, which you gave, and you're working, have your web page created as we speak, correct?
Yes, hopefully within the next week or two, the web page will be set up. I've already gotten everything in the making to have that done. They're just waiting to obtain legally the name for it, but everything should be set up on that. But like I say, they can do Cheyenne, C-H-Y-A-N-N-E, 1247 at att.net. I get my emails daily, and I would be glad to, you know, call them or contact them right back.
Right, and you also, for this, so everybody knows, you are very responsive in the Facebook page. If people ask questions or make statements, you're very quick to respond. It's not a matter of waiting a month and a Sundays. If somebody asks a question, you usually respond in a couple hours.
Yes, if they just private message me on my Facebook, Murdered in Mississippi, or Seeking Justice for Ronnie and Daddy, preferably the Murdered in Mississippi, I get back with them as soon as I, because I check it all during the day. I come in all during the day and at night before I go to bed to check to see if there are any messages or anyone that's come forward to comment or say something that I feel the need to respond.
Absolutely. Thank you for making sure we had that information, because this is not a very hugely listened to podcast, but I do have people listen to it, and I don't know who's out there listening to it and what information that they might know about who you might be able to talk to. And that person may reach out to you and say, hey, you know, you might want to try this group or this person, or this organization helps people in your situation.
I had some organizations that were going to help and that I worked with, but it came out that they were just more or less using my information for a feather in their hat or the ladder climb or however you want to put it. So, you know, I didn't really get anywhere with that company. So it took another year and a half off of trying to get justice, you know. So it's you know, I need somebody that can really help me get this in a court of law, because I don't know how to file those papers myself. And even if they try to explain to me, well, file this and file that, if they say one if, and, or but, or well, did you, I'd have no idea as to what they're talking about.
Right, absolutely. And I can only tell you from my experience, in my opinion, the court system is not people-friendly.
No, they're not. No, they are very not. And especially Mississippi. I called the coroner. I asked him, the coroner himself, Gary Hargrove, and I mean, you know, I'm saying this out for the public to hear me. I'm not alleging this. This is coming out of my mouth and me. That was the most horrible, cold-hearted man. And he, you know, you're taught as a child or a kid not to call no one a liar growing up. No, this guy didn't storytell. This guy didn't, you know, he flatly, blatant, he lied to me. He told me that my dad was going to jail, that my dad had pawned everything in the house. My dad had wrote bad checks. Well, the judge that my daddy worked for then, he confirmed that he wasn't telling that. He told me in a narrative report that my dad had told him that he came to my house to tell me that he wanted to make sure that I was okay, and then he was never coming to my house again. Well, I mean, that was the most asinine remark that I could have imagined someone making. Why would you say that, you know, you're going to go to someone's house to make sure they're okay, and then you're going to tell them you're never coming back to their house again? That's not even something my dad would even say or do or think. You know, my dad was my world.
Yeah, sadly, there are people out there who exist on pain causing other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, let's go back to an earlier statement that you made where an individual told you that they opened up the case, it would change history. What do they mean by that?
because they've got it down that Thomas Holcomb, excuse me, that Thomas Holcomb was the one that killed Judge Sherry. No, Thomas Holcomb wasn't. Thomas Holcomb, they accused Thomas Holcomb, but they knew it was John Ransom and they knew it was Pete Hallett, but they couldn't pin it on John Ransom. But Thomas Holcomb had a 13-year-old daughter that was dying, and he was dying with cancer, and he had a life sentence in prison. So they promised Thomas Holcomb that if he would take the fall for John Ransom, that they would take care of his daughter the rest of her life. So that's why they got Thomas Holcomb to take that rap for it. It was not. It was Pete Hallett and John Ransom that killed. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Has that been proven?
It was. It was proven. If you'll notice, I think in one of the books, The Mississippi Mud, on the page, I think it's 247 or something like that. I'm not exactly sure the page. Keith Bell and Cook, they were in the, had John Ransom in the prison, or in the jail there, and they were talking to him. And he told John, he said, John, he said, you're going to die a lonely death in here. And John Ransom said, well, he said, there's a man walking the streets. It said right here, it said, Ransom's mood changed. He said, well, you know, and this Keith Bell, he is an agent with the FBI. And he said, hello, John, how are you, Keith Bell asked. Ransom shook his head. He did not look well. Shallow eyes sank him back in his head. He said the confidence Cook had sensed in Ransom at first visit 2 years earlier had been snapped him. Anyway, he told him, he said, you know, you're going to die in prison, John. And Ransom's mood had changed. He said, well, you know, he said, I love my family, and they could be in danger if I'm not careful, because I can't protect my family in here, and you can't protect my family. Now, this is John Ransom talking to FBI agent Keith Bell. Maybe we can work something out, Cook and Bell suggested, but Ransom shook his head. He said, I always told my family I did not do this. He said, and I don't want them to know that I've been lying to them. Ransom hesitated, and then in silence, stretching out, a clanging bustle of the jailhouse muffled in the background. Cook and Bell waited him out, saying nothing, but Ransom sighed. I told them I would never kill a woman, he said. His hands were flat on the table, long fingers spread, eyes downcast. I'm in here right now, and there's a man in a tie walking around in Biloxi laughing at us because he'll probably never be indicted. That was it, the key to pushing Ransom over the edge. He was angry at a man in a tie, and Cook and Bell had no doubt that the person who he was talking about, that figure was Mayor Pete Hallett. Ransom showed all of the signs of being ready to spill. So they knew. They knew that John
apparently,
Ransom,
from what you read from us from that book, apparently that's the case. But
yeah,
has that been said in a court of law that's exactly what happened yet, correct?
No.
Yeah.
And nobody ever knew that my dad, you know, about my dad and Pete Hallett. People have asked me, said, well, why did your dad not be questioned? Why didn't they question your dad? I don't see where your dad was mentioned in anything. No, because they knew that my dad would fold. They knew that if they put my daddy on that stand, that my dad would, under pressure, my dad would fold and he would say something, or he would snap and tell about them killing my brother and everything else. So they kept my dad silent. They kept my dad out of it. And Ruth Potomy, the court reporter in 2014, I think it was. I have to get my note the exact date. But 2014,
right.
I looked her up under U.S. search, and she was shocked that I found her. And I talked to her, and she knew that Pete Hallett and my dad had gone over there that day. She knew. That's why she snuck those court transcripts out and gave them to my dad before she left, moving to Florida. And she told me, she said, don't you ever, honey, don't you ever believe that your daddy killed himself. She said, your daddy did not kill himself.
All right, one question. Let's step back just a second. These court transcripts, they still exist, right? I mean, I can request a copy of those transcripts, and I can get them, right? Or have they somehow disappeared?
Well, now, I don't know. I have, you know, I've never had anyone ask. I don't know if that's why she snuck them out and gave them to my dad, because when my dad, I called my dad in 97, and she was over there, and he said she was leaving, going to Florida. And then he mailed them to me and told me put them up. So I had had them put up in a box packed up with other stuff when I'd moved. But I do not know. Now, I've sent to people that were helping me that have made copies, that I've asked them to never release those transcripts to anyone, but they were only for my story. But I do have the original copies of those transcripts. Now, where the courts have disposed of them by now, not knowing that I had them, or whether the courts would release any of them, I've got the original copies that can be compared to what, if they do release them, to what they have.
Well, that's interesting, because without a doubt, I don't know how long every state has to keep transcripts of trials, right? I know I can find state Wisconsin transcripts going back 20-plus years. I don't know how long they have to keep federal stuff for, but that's some time, too. So, yes.
But I do have all of them.
Right. I'm not saying you don't. I'm just saying that if a third party, say, perhaps a newspaper reporter, interested in the story, that would be the first thing I would do, is find out those transcripts still existed and compare what they might be able to find from the court to what you have. I mean, that would definitely stir a bunch of interest if what you had was radically different than what the court provided.
And I do know that there was a news media lady. Her name was Gavir Denza. She works with CBS Channel 46 in Atlanta, I think, now. Now, I did contact her because she was, and I'm not sure what they call them, inter-apprentice-type news. Back then, she had just started out from Louisiana. Now, she covered the Sherry's trial. So she would know, and she would have a lot of personal knowledge as to what I've told also. Like I said,
absolutely,
I did try to contact her, but she would not contact me back. I do not know if it's out of fear of that trial or, you know, not wanting to get involved again, but I'm sure if someone legally contacted her, she could tell a lot of the stuff that I've told.
And I don't know how long ago you tried to contact her. It could simply be that perhaps
just
she didn't get the message. Okay. It's still the same thing. You don't know if she got the message or what else. That's why a letter sent certified mail, you know if she got it or not. Because you can leave a message, they may not get it. Same thing with email. I sent, over the last couple of days, a lot of emails to a select group of people, and three or four of them said they didn't get it. Well, did they lose it? Did not get their howl? Whatever, you don't know. But that's why there's other ways you can make sure, you can prove somebody got something or not. But I really appreciate, again, you coming on the show again and talking about this horrific situation that occurred from your family. So basically, in a nutshell, all the tragedies that you went through with your brother's murder, with your father's potential murder, right, which I think, in my opinion, that was probably the case, goes back to the murder of the Judge Sherry and his wife.
Yes, and Buford Pussard and his wife Pauline. Because, see, they never really come up with all the people that were involved in with that car, they said. But this person that told, she knew, and she had too much correct information to have just been somebody off the wall, you know, randomly saying something. No, she knew too many involved in the right information, and she said that when they murdered Buford Pussard, it was Kursky Nix, Irvin Moore, Jeffrey Bass, this guy named Olness White, and my brother were all in the car. And, you know, my dad had a late model dark Cadillac about that time, and I've questioned, because my dad's car got gone right after that. He sold that car back in that time and got another one and got a Buick. And now I wonder, did Irvin Moore or Kursky Nix borrow my dad's car that night? Was that why they took Ronnie with them? Was that the Cadillac that was mentioned? You know, why did my dad get rid of it right after that? There's just still so many questions. But, yeah, my brother was murdered because he knew that they murdered Pauline Pusser, and he was with them that night, and he saw what happened. And my dad knew that Ronnie was with them also, so he knew about that. One thing I have a lot of, it's hard for me to swallow, is the fact that in 1969, when Towhead White got out of prison, he's sitting at my dad's kitchen table playing cards with all of those thugs, and my dad knew that they murdered my brother. Now, I've been told, don't be angry with your dad. He couldn't help it. Your dad was scared for his life. You know, Wayne, if somebody murdered my child, I'd wait till they all was playing cards. I'd go in the bathroom and come back with a gun, and I think I'd kill everybody in the room.
I believe I have similar sentiments as yes. If you kill my son or my children,
yeah,
and the only thing you have on me, you're going to kill me? Okay, fine.
Yeah,
you don't care.
You're going to have to kill me because, yeah, if you kill my child, I would be in, I would wait, I'd invite them all over. We'd have the biggest party that anybody ever wanted to see. And that's when I guess I'd sell my soul to hell because I'd kill everybody in that room.
Yeah, and only the Lord God will can judge us for those actions.
Yeah, and I have to sit there with my dad sitting at that table. And, you know, and these are original pictures. These are not somebody that got, like one guy said, this is Towhead White. Well, sure, I could have went to the Internet and grabbed a few pictures off of there. But, no, I got these out of my dad's picture album.
Yeah, these are still things that you have, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you have the pictures. I know the stuff you sent me. And, again, I'm grateful for that. I truly am. I just want to make sure that you have copies of, at least you send me the originals, that you have copies.
I have the original court transcripts in my book. I have the original pictures of my dad sitting at the table with Mike Gillick, Bobby Joe Fabin, Bill Rhodes. Now, I knew Bill Rhodes as Pete Rhodes. And, you know, stuff like that. That Junior Smith that's alleged to have killed Towhead White, I have a picture of him. He came to my dad's house in 1987. My husband at the time was going through, he was being initiated in as past master at the Chamblee Lodge. And Junior Smith came up and stayed 4 days with my dad in Atlanta in 1987. So it's not like I don't know these people. I've never heard their name mentioned.
Absolutely. In my opinion, the amount of research you've done in this case—excuse me—the amount of research you've done in this case is awe-inspiring. I wish that people out there doing true crime work, was just as diligent as you are. Because, in my opinion, far too many times I picked up a book on eBay or from a used bookstore written by an expert, and it's like, wait a second, my cat could have done a better job with this research than you did.
I love that cat.
I mean, the idea is, I'm sorry that took such great tragedy to happen to your family, but yet the amount of time and effort you have spent doing your very, very best job to try to bring justice to your father and to your brother, for what it's worth, is awe-inspiring. It's definitely given me
pause. You know, when you tell the truth, it's easy. People say, well, you remember the truth. It's the lies that you have trouble telling. But if it really did happen, you can remember. You can remember things if they really happen and you're telling the truth. I have no need to lie. What they did to my daddy and my brother, that itself is tragedy enough. It's horrible enough just telling the truth. I don't have to lie to make it sound any better. Just like the blue jeans. I met with a forensic investigator just here a couple of weeks ago, and they were looking at the blue jeans, and they were doing, and they said your dad was on his knees in a kneeling position whenever he was killed. He said the blood spatter pattern shows that. He said the pattern in the pocket where my dad had his billfold in his front pocket, where he was on his knees and it creased, it put the blood spatter in the pattern to his pants there. They said my dad was in a kneeling position as if he was begging for his life when he was killed.
And you have this documented as well, right?
I have the pants. Yes, I have it all documented.
No. What the person said, the person told you.
Yeah, a very high-profile licensed forensic investigator. Yes, I have all of her contact and everything. And she told me, she said, when I get through with this report, she said the papers that I give you will be certifiable papers that you can take to any court. And these papers will stand up in court.
Okay. Very important to know.
She told me
your
dad was murdered, your little brother was murdered, and she said she's also come back and named people that I've talked about here, the informants that are sharing things with her. That has pretty much reiterated things that I have told myself. And she told
me,
she said, everything that I give you will stand up in a court of law.
With only having a few minutes left of the show tonight, why don't you go again and give us your contact information, your email, and where we can find you on Facebook, so people can have that opportunity to contact you and follow along with what you're going through to keep up, please.
Okay, it is Cheyenne. My email is Cheyenne, and that's spelled Cheyanne, Cheyenne1247@att.net. I have a Facebook of Murdered in Mississippi, and I also have one of Seeking Justice for Ronnie and Daddy at 1 Day 1967-87.
Okay. Again, I do very much appreciate you coming on and telling me this, sharing your story with myself and the people who listen to the show. And I don't know what to say other than I wish you the very, very best. And I hope somebody, the right person, somehow discovers this show and can offer you the help that you so need to can do this with what's going on to make sure this stuff happens.
Thanks, Wayne, and I do appreciate everything you have done, honey. I really do.
Oh, ma'am, I hope we can somehow this makes a difference.
I'm sure it has. It already has made a difference with me because it shows me that there are decent people out there like you and Larry and Ron and all y'all that really do care and that are honest and trying to help people.
Well, we can only do the best job we know how. I'm glad that people like that you've mentioned have come up to the plate to help in which way that you can. I hope those meetings that you have scheduled, to my understanding, pay great fruit to you in the very, very near future.
Thanks, Wayne, and I do appreciate everything you've done.
Thank you, ma'am. I will talk soon.
Okay, thanks, Wayne.
Thank you. Again, my heart goes out to Ms. Cook and what she's going through. I hope that the right person out there finds this show, hears this show, go visits her Facebook pages, and starts out the communication line going so we can get something done for this woman. At least, you know, make her rest more peacefully at night, knowing that other people who can do things for her are doing those stuff. So with that, I want to end the show now. I want to appreciate everybody for listening to the show. It means a lot to me and the like. So with that, you guys out there, have a great day, and we'll talk to you all soon. Goodbye.